Okay, people have jacquarded buttons. Okay, we
So,
got. All right, you have 2 minutes. Okay.
yes, Freya.
Yeah, so everyone needs to find the gotta button so that you can have permission to raise your hand or unmute when you're requested to do so that.
That only applies if you're I think it only applies if you sign in after you start recording.
No, it comes up because I just saw it and had to do it.
Well, I didn't, and I'm still talking to you. So, whatever.
Well, you're
Yeah, it came up.
unmuted.
Yeah,
Yeah,
I'm
came up
unmuted.
for me too.
That's true. I think it's only if you're muted
Oh, is that
that
what
you
it is?
come in. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
So.
I knew if you came in, but okay. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I'm here, and
Okay, we've got
Okay.
a raised hand here. Let's
Why?
see.
All right. We want to. We want. Basically, we want everybody. But myself and Peter to be muted. Before I
No, wait a
start.
minute. I forgot something. Shoot.
What?
I forgot. So just go ahead and start. I'll be back.
Okay.
As usual,
Yeah.
these things
All
can
right.
be a bit
Peter got a
glitchy.
minute. He's got a minute.
Okay, 616, 042 has the hand raised. I'm going to lower your hand, but can you unmute?
7 p.m. One notification.
If you
Okay.
see.
All right. Okay, we're going to start. Have we gotten as many people renamed as possible? But we're in the entrance of starting. We're going to officially start.
Okay, the
Okay.
person
Yeah.
it says you're unmuted, so you're fine. The 616 number.
Oh,
But I didn't know why they raised their hand, so that's why I was trying to
okay.
get that taken care of.
All right.
6163, say 042. It says you're unmuted, but if you're still not able to talk, go out and come back in and find the got it button because it
All
should
right.
show up again.
So we'll go over the Zoom commands and everything after I do my introduction, okay?
Sure.
All right. Cool. Okay.
Deanna, that's Carol's number.
Okay.
Yes. Oh, right. All right. Okay. I'm going to count down 10 seconds. So
I'm
we have a
here. I'm here, by the way. So,
Okay. All right. I'm going to count down so we have a clear section to edit. So that you know when this goes to editing, sound editing, they can find the beginning pretty easily. All right. I'm going to count in my head. Welcome, everybody, to the June 2022 Behind Our Eyes book launch. This month, you're going to be talking to me, Annie Chipetta. I'm the author of Hope for the Tarnished, and I'm going to be joined by Peter Altschul, soundscape artist and author in his own right. He's going to be interviewing me. And then I'm going to read a little bit and then open up for Q&A. There's a lot of people I want to thank for tonight, including the ACB community for getting us on their community call program. Of course, I want to thank Peter for being here. Also have Princess Tia, who is a fellow podcaster, and she volunteered tonight to help co-host, as well as Deanna Noriega. And at the end, president of Behind Our Eyes, Alice Massa, is going to say a little bit about Behind Our Eyes before we wrap up. So I'm going to hand it over to Deanna because she's going to just go over some commands for Zoom, and then Peter and I are going to begin.
Okay, if you're on a PC, to raise or lower your hand is Alt-Y, to mute and unmute is Alt-A. All of these commands are toggles, but if you have come in and you are not able to mute or unmute or do anything, then you'll need to go out and come back in because you have to get the Got It button because it is being recorded. This is being handled as an ACB event. So that's part of the rules they have, that they have a master recording that is used for podcasting if it's a streamed event, which this one isn't, but it's used as a safety measure so that if we have any ghosts that cause or disrupt any of our calls, we can handle that and identify who it is and make sure they don't do it again. So that's, and the recording is generally discarded after 2 weeks. So we do have two other people recording for their personal use, and that's all been taken care of. So then the next step on a Mac, it is option Y to raise and lower your hand, command shift A to mute and unmute. On a smart device like an iPad or an iPhone, it's generally located in the right hand corner of the screen. There's a more button you need to find. You hit that and then you go in and scroll a bit until you find the raise hand button. The mute and unmute button is in the left hand corner of an iPhone screen. On a landline telephone or dial in number, to raise your hand is *9, to mute and unmute is *6.
Thank you, Deanna. That's great. All right. And of course, when we stop the first part of the interview, we'll let you know when we open for Q&A. And then Deanna will really, you know, get going. please remain muted for the integrity of the recording. And I'm going to hand it over to Peter.
Thank you, Annie. My name is Peter Altschul from Columbia, Missouri. And Annie, I was thrilled to read your book. So let's start with, tell us a little about Deanna. Let's try it again.
Don't tell them anything about me, Annie. No. This is your show.
tell us a bit about yourself, Annie. Who are you? How did you start writing? What do you do besides writing? And what prompted you to write Hope for the Tarnished?
All right. Great questions. I guess I'll start from where I think the beginning might be. Of course, you know, my name is Annie Chepetta. I live in New York. I'm a native New Yorker. I was born and raised in a little town called Mamaroneck. I've always been a creative person. I have always loved music and art and writing and all of that. When I was a kid, I was not visually impaired. I had just had low vision, and I had thick glasses, but I learned how to read and write and do all that with vision. It wasn't until I was older, at age 28, when I lost my sight progressively through by being diagnosed with RP. And that's, I believe, when I left the sighted world and entered the world of the blind and visually impaired, and began identifying myself as a person with a disability. But interestingly enough, my career as a acrylic furniture designer ended when I was diagnosed because I could no longer read the line drawings and that kind of stuff. So I didn't know what to do anymore creatively. I was very much into visual arts and graphics and things like that, and I had to figure out a different way to be creative. That turned out, I started writing poetry as a way to cope with my vision loss, and then I just kind of built upon itself, and I got some small press recognition, and then I joined a mail order round robin critique group, which really helped me a lot. Met other writers and felt like I started to find a place where I belonged, went back to school, obtained my master's degree in family therapy. All the time I was writing, but then I was doing APA style and MFA style stuff, and so I learned more about the craft. Had a lot of great mentors, and I started working for the Department of Veteran Affairs back in 2010, and had a really good career, and that was another way for me to learn about people, about communicating, about expressing myself, and doing other types of writing, like progress notes and things like that. So I think all of my experiences have finally led me here tonight. Like they did when I published my first book of poetry in 2016. It's been a natural progression of who I am as a writer, as a creative person, and I'm really fortunate to have the opportunity to have been able to, write a book, write a fiction book, write a novel. I mean, I'm still kind of shocked about that when someone says, "Oh, you wrote a novel." I'm like, yeah, I did. So, to me, it's just a story, So that's a little bit about me, Peter. Thank you for giving me the opportunity for sharing that.
Yeah. Before we turn to the corner to the book, can you talk about what you did with the Department of Veterans Affairs? What
sure,
work you did
I was
there.
A trauma counselor.
What does that involve? What do you do as a trauma counselor?
What does it involve? Well, it involves, of course, a lot of training, but it involves listening, actually hearing people, helping people take their pain for a little while so they don't have to have their, when they come into a counseling room, you offer to take their pain and help them deal with it so they get a little bit of relief and a little bit of peace once in a while. I did a lot of group counseling, group therapy with veterans, especially Vietnam War veterans. And it was one of the most fulfilling jobs I probably have ever had. But it's the kind of job that that takes a lot out of you personally, because you're listening to a lot of those very traumatic and painful and violent stories. But it wasn't something I would ever change and go back and change. It was part of who I am, and I took it with me, and I'm glad I had the experience.
So it sounds very much like you did a lot of hope for the tarnished, provided quite a bit of hope for the tarnished. Talk about how the title came to be for your first novel, Hope for the Tarnished.
That's an interesting story too. My editor, Leonore Dworkin, and I tossed it was originally called Tarnished Hope. And she said to me, Anne, there are too many books that are named that. You might want to name it something else. So I did. And she recommended Hope for the Tarnished, that it wasn't as overly used as Tarnished Hope. And that's kind of how it happened. But I did want to indicate that in the book itself is about someone feeling like there's so much negative in their life that they have to reach out and hang on to that hope because of circumstances that have happened. And so that's how I got to the title. And I think it's a very appropriate title for the book.
So do I. So, without giving too many secrets away, talk about the general plot of the book, as it were.
Sure. Well, the book starts out in the mid 1970s or early 1970s, and it's about three sisters who, grow up. In a traditional, home, white picket fence, the whole bit. And then their family is torn apart by their mom has problems, mental issues, and they end up in divorce, the parents divorce, and the book actually starts when Abby walks into the apartment that they have to move into after they leave the house, because her parents divorce, they sell the house, and that's where it starts. And it's a complete, even though they lived in the same town, it's a completely different part of the town. It's a whole different thing for, you know, a 10-year-old girl to give up everything, you know, her own room and furniture and all that. They had to sell everything. So it was very traumatic from the first chapter. And it picks up the different types of issues and challenges she has along the way. One sister is mentally unstable. Another sister is older and a little bit more of a, having trying to help Abby, and mom is checked out. And that's pretty much what the first part is about.
And then over time, the book traces Abby's life, right, from that spot to what happens to her at the end, where she gets
goes from
more hope, if you will,
from age 10. Age 10 till she, right before she goes into college, is ready to start college.
So the book is set in the 70s and 80s. What prompted you to choose that time as the frame for your book?
It was the same time that I grew up, and I wanted it to be at a time where we didn't have cell phones, where we weren't reliant on technology as much. I personally felt that, sure, I could write, you know, in, you know, terms of contemporary times and everything, but I didn't want to. I wanted to go back and find a story that didn't include all of that distraction and all of that social shifting. I really wanted to stay in that time frame. I think I'm attracted to it because I grew up at that time, but also because I think it was shifting from the 1970s to the 1980s was pretty intense for a lot of people, for a lot of different reasons, including, you know, what happened with the AIDS epidemic, and then there was this shift in people kind of shedding that more provincial type of attitude, you know, from the 50s and 60s. And the 70s was like, I think it was like a Wild West show in a lot of ways.
And then the
80s, wow, you know. Like
it's not that much different now. I mean, you know, we're going through a similar thing now, I think.
Yeah. It's a cyclical thing.
Yeah. I think
so. That's where,
So, one of the things that struck me about the book was you have lots of descriptions of things, of houses, of landscapes. You describe the apartment that Abby moves, you know, starts her story in fairly, descriptive terms. How did you go about doing that? How did you, you know, find the material or the courage or whatever the right word is, or all the above to describe all those things? Nightclubs, you know, there are lots of things you describe in some detail quite effectively in the book.
Oh, thank you. Well, I have good visual memories, and they worked for me during that book. And actually, my visual memory works whenever I write, whether it's poetry or fiction or nonfiction. When I write a scene, especially, or I want some type of imagery to provoke something in my poems, I actually take time to sit and think about it. What would it feel like? What would I be hearing? What would it, you know, what would walking into a room like that be like for a little girl? Maybe that's it. I've experienced that. Maybe I didn't, but, you know, really delve into all of that sensory information, and then you know, and then let then write about it. You know, use the craft, you know, the adjectives and the nouns and the action and the dialogue to really set the scene. So I don't have to have vision to be able to weave in all of that imagery or those feelings. And that's pretty much how I write.
Yeah. And there are lots of characters in the book that you also describe. How much of this book or how much of those characters are based at least in part on your experiences in your life?
Some, you know, we wouldn't be able to develop characters if we didn't have a good frame of reference for those characters. Some of them are completely, you know, from my imagination. Some of them take pieces here and there. Some of the characters are composites of a few different people I've known. So I guess the characters also tend to develop themselves to a certain extent, especially when you write long fiction. You know, a lot of authors say that the characters tell you what they want to do with the story.
Yep.
And after writing this book, I totally agree with that, because I had a different ending for this book. And it just decided it didn't want that ending. It wanted a different one. So, and I knew I had to, the arch of the story, I had to resolve some of the social issues that Abby and Augie experience, wanting a loving relationship but being constrained by some family things to not ever kind of fully develop that. And at the end they decided how they wanted to get together, and that's how the story wrote its own ending and its own conclusion. So
yeah, no, I found the same thing when I wrote my memoir. I wanted to edit a certain way, and it said, no, you can't do it that way. You got to do something else. So I think there really is some truth to that in all writing, you know, that you think you're going in a certain direction, and it turns out maybe not so fast or not so clearly or not so in a straight line or not so something, right? And it sounds like that's what you experienced with your characters. You also deal with, as you mentioned before, a lot of sort of social issues of the time that sort of mirror the progress that Abby and Augie, who's one of the main characters in the book. And I was struck by your weaving in of gay straight issues. Can you talk about how you decided that would be a if not a theme, a sort of a sub theme in your book?
Yeah. Well, that was one thing that kind of happened. The characters decided that they wanted me to do that. It wasn't something that was planned, you know. But when I started, there's a scene about Abby. She's in high school. It's later on. She's getting ready to graduate high school, and she goes to a club in the city with her friends. And these are friends that before that were not ever really known to the reader in the book. It was like a whole shift in focus for the book. During that chapter, Abby stumbles over a couple making out in the hallway before she heads to the bathroom, and she's feeling lonely, and you know, she's kind of feeling like, you know, why can't she find anybody? And you know, she stumbles over this couple, and she realizes it's her ex-boyfriend's father, and his partner is the I guess you would call him the man Friday that takes care of the rich family while she's there taking care of their dogs. And she's like, oh. And then they realize that she doesn't really know that they're a couple, and they explain to her what's going on, and she's like, oh, that's cool. You know, like, she didn't have any adverse reactions to it, and that was kind of my experience. And I decided that I was going to kind of give that to Abby, to give her permission to be like, yeah, that's cool, that's okay, you know. And it was at a time, I guess, culturally and socially, that all these discoveries were being made, and people felt safer about talking about living alternative lifestyles and being gay. And I think it just came at the perfect time in the book to just tell the story of these other characters.
It is a start. I'm sorry, Andy. It is a startling moment, and it's yes. Very effective. You know,
yes, it was meant to be a startling moment, but also a moment for Abby to grow up.
Yeah.
You know, like, okay, you know, oh, all right, other people have loving relationships, and other people have struggles, and other people have to keep their relationships a secret or don't, you know. And so, you know, with her and Augie, it was one type of taboo, and this was totally different. And so it kind of shifted her mind over, and shifted the story over as well.
So you mentioned the rich guy and the butler, the man Friday. There quite a bit of the action takes place in that house when she's dog sitting. So I sort of two related questions. One, the description of that house and the surroundings, it's really amazing. You know, did you have experience in those kinds of settings? And the other thing, of course, is all the dogs. And I know that you are a dog person. You have service animals, and it's an important part of your life. And dogs play an important role in the story. So talk about both those things in any order you want to talk about them.
Sure. Well, the mansion kind of is like a composite of some of the houses I've been in when I was a kid, because I had very rich friends that lived out on Orienta Point, and they had these huge houses. I mean, one person I knew had what they call the rec room, but it was like a full bar, and it had pinball machines and tables and foosball. It was like set up just like an arcade, and it was for like two kids. You know, I was like, oh my god. And they had like an 18 car garage, and so that house was kind of fashioned after that opulence, being positioned, you know, right on the water, and having the boats and everything. That was all just a composite of some of what I experienced, but a lot of it was just, if I had a house and I had the money, what would it be like? And that was kind of like, wow, I would really love to have a house with an elevator. That would be really cool. So, the story with Abby and getting the dog sitting job, and all of that was really the bridging chapters between the beginning and the middle and the end. I needed something to distract her from some of the things that had went on earlier in the book, and I also had to find a way strategically to keep her and Augie separated, just, you know, in terms of the story and the storyline. So I made up this family, and, you know, the six little Pomeranians, and, you know, and just went with it. And it was so much fun to write it. I had fun. Like, at first I was like, oh, what am I going to do? And, you know, the middle of the story is sometimes the hardest part of a fiction book, because, you know, it can, you know, you just, sometimes you just get stuck. And, once I started writing, about Abby's dog sitting experiences and adding in those characters and weaving in, you know, Laura's cooking and Rohan's, sense of, compassion, and, you know, the romance between the kids and everything, it was just like a little kind of like a sidebar for me to just have fun with. And I had a lot of fun with that part.
It's fun to read too. It really is fun to read.
Oh, good. And I'm glad you said that.
It's fun to read, especially since the earlier part, and we'll come back to this in a second. You know, there's some stuff sledding in the early part of the book. And it's such a wonderful contrast, you know, to have her sort of in that opulence and doing, you know, dealing with these wacko dogs and wacky people in some sense. different, shall we say. Wonderful people, but you know, you don't see these people all the time in quote unquote real life. One of the things that happens, not a lot in the book, but there are a couple of sex scenes in the book, people making love. How did you sort of create a balance of being, you know, too pornographic, not too pornographic? How did you sort of make those kinds of decisions?
Well, it was hard.
Yeah.
A lot of those scenes got written over and over and over and over, like many, many, many times. And I just felt that sometimes the balance wasn't there and I would rewrite the scene. And Lenore helped me with a lot of it. You know, I would run it by her and say, is it too much? Is it not too much? Or does it make sense? A long time ago, I had a writing mentor, and she said to me, be careful when you write intimate scenes. And if you be spare about how, you know, this one's hand is there, or this one did this, or this one positioned like that, because people, when you read something and you tend to get confused, and in your mind you're going, how did they do that? What was that? You know, so that's what happened. I overwrote it, and then I cut it, and I cut it, and I revised, and I cut it, and then it came out to be what it was. And I think it's just the perfect balance. It's just enough. It's not too much. And I wanted to make the scene with her and Augie way steamier mm-hmm. than her first experience. And I hope I accomplished that.
I'll leave that to the readers to decide. Let's okay. let's do that. So,
right.
Annie, you want to read a section of the book, which, and so to set that up, mm-hmm. talk a little bit about the earlier, now I get to the more difficult part of the book, which is the early part of the book. So set the scene. And one of the things that struck me is there, Abby, even when she moves into the house, the new apartment, forgive me, she has some difficult experiences that she has to go through. Talk about writing those scenes. I assume your role as a trauma counselor helped a little bit and sort of setting those scenes up, and then sort of set the scene up that you're going to read for us.
Sure. Let me, okay, this excerpt is from chapter 10, but Abby, you know, when the divorce happened, it's like seemed like it all these things steamrolled. One of her sisters tried to commit suicide. She had their pet dog was actually hit and killed by a car right when they first moved into the apartment building. And sometime later, the super poisoned her cat. And then she was also molested by one of her mother's boyfriends. So there was all these things that kept happening to her, and she just, you know, had to endure along the way. So this chapter is kind of takes place where. She's learned, you know, a lot about life, a lot about people, a lot about hurt and pain and perseverance. And they're in family court. Her sister Darlene was arrested and is being sent away to a mental health facility for treatment, mandatory treatment. So. Abby learned all about addiction thanks to mandated counseling ordered by family court. She learned about enabling and that the addict, her sister, would sacrifice anything to get high. In the meetings through the story of members of other families, Abby learned that she was not alone, and she was reassured by other kids that it was okay to feel the way she did. What she wasn't prepared for was the court appearance. During the court procedures, Darlene was barely recognizable. "That's not my sister," Abby whispered, her voice muted by shock. Kathleen squeezed her hand. Darlene's face was pale and sunken, framed by limp, dull brown hair. She shuffled into the courtroom and sat hunched over, shivering. She was being sentenced as an adult, being 18 when she was arrested. The judge's gavel clacked, and Darlene jumped. She glanced around, surprised. Abby pushed up her glasses. The pent-in anger and years of being hurt by Darlene's problems burned deep inside. She wouldn't be taken in again. She told herself to harden her heart against her sister's drug addiction and mental issues. She wondered if Darlene had ever even cared. How could this have happened? Abby recalled the day she found Darlene on the bed, close to death. How her anger was shoved aside by Darlene's addiction. She wanted to scream out, hurt, frustrated, and conflicted inside. She loved Darlene, but she also felt guilty for wanting so hard not to care. Darlene's overdose had scared her more than she had let on. Sometimes she still had nightmares about it. Abby leaned her head on Kathleen's shoulder and let the tears drip down onto her lap. Rose sat rigid on the bench, stone-faced. If she noticed that Abby was crying, she gave no sign of it. Sorry. After Darlene was led away, Rose got up and headed for the door. Kathleen jumped up, dragging Abby behind her, following Rose out the door of the courtroom. The court officer swung the door open. "Mom," Kathleen said, trying not to yell in the echoing corridor, "wait." Rose ignored her, removed a long brown cigarette from a pack in her purse and lit it, then continued walking, heels clicking on the marble floor. The girls caught up to her outside. Kathleen grabbed her shirt sleeve, jerking Rose to a stop. "Mom, what is going on? Why did you leave like that?" Rose removed her arm from Kathleen's grasp and puffed on her cigarette, letting the smoke curl out from her nose and mouth before blowing it out. Her expression was one the girls knew well, one neither of them could reach. All they could do was wait to hear the answer. "They did it to me too," she said. "They took away everything, my husband, my children, my memories, and when I came back, there was nothing left." She dropped the cigarette, crushed it out with the toe of her shoe, and walked to the car with Kathleen and Abby staring after her. The end.
How do you move on from that? What a powerful scene. And so much there, you know, family relationships, addiction. And that's what happens in real life, right? These things tend to spiral and just create just all kinds of pain and things and anger and, you know, fill in the blank and apathy. And it's hard to break free of those things.
Yes.
And this book describes one way of that potentially happening. Before I turn it over to questions, I want to ask, something occurred to me when I was looking at that passage that you sent. Many of us, as we're trying to figure out how we're going to read, you know, our work as part of presentations or as part of, you know, readings, festivals, or whatever it is, try to figure out how we're going to read in a way that works for us, that we can communicate most effectively to audiences. And of course, this is an issue that's relevant to both people with and without disabilities. But with disabilities sometimes creates sort of unique challenges. And I'd be curious, Annie, if you'd be willing to share how you prepare to read passages like that to the public, if you will.
Sure. So there's two parts to it. There's a technology, and then there's a practice. Practice. I picked out this passage and I practiced it for 2 days, and I cut the manuscript up in manageable pieces and sentences where they would naturally want to be cut. And then I recorded myself a few times and read back to myself. When I read or when I'm on Zoom, I use a headset with a microphone. So I can hear Jaws babbling away in the background, but all you're hearing is me. Something like this is what I call audio prompting. I've talked about it a lot, especially with Writing Works Wonders and other writers with Behind Our Eyes. I'm not a fluent Braille reader, so I listen and then I speak the words. So it's like script reading, but not totally memorizing it. So it's a combination of memorization and then listening and repetition and speaking. It works for me, but it does take a lot of effort. And of course, poetry is much easier because the lines are shorter and the text is shorter. And I'm working up to reading longer pieces. This piece was about 400 words. 500 words is my limit right now. And I'm trying to work up to longer pieces, like if I was to read a full short story or something. That's how I do it. I prep the manuscript in Word and I read it to myself over and over until I get the flow right. And then I just go for it like I did tonight.
Yeah, it's funny. I find reading poetry to be harder because poetry is so condensed and you really need to think through it in a different way somehow, how to convey a poem. Because the lines are, and so that's just me, we all have different takes on these kinds of things.
That's a good point.
But anyway, Deanna, I think it's time to throw the session to questions. So I'm going to turn the floor over to you to be the police officer, if you will.
If anyone would like to raise their hand, I will take you in the order that your hands appear and you can ask any. Melody, you may unmute.
Hi, Annie. It's good to be here again. I was on In Perspective. Do you find that the conventional mental health system, I just had my 34th inpatient hospitalization. I don't hide it. And all these multiple conditions, do you find that as when you were an active trauma counselor that the conventional system becomes too wrapped up in the diagnoses, and no matter what someone is diagnosed with, they survived some kind of significant trauma, and they may not have known how those traumas affected them, and the DSM kind of doesn't always reflect that?
Well, that's a really in-depth question. I'm going to try to honor that by just I'll be brief. I worked with traumatized veterans, war trauma, and their families. So while I was working, the DSM underwent changes from one edition to another, and they redefined and recategorized PTSD and acute stress trauma and things like that. And let me tell you, it didn't do anyone any justice. So when you've got boots on the ground with these people in their trauma and trying to help them, the last thing you want to think about is, categorize them and how to label them. And sure, you need it for the VA, and sure, physicians need it, and, for billing and for things like that, and to for them to receive their compensation. But, there's so many different levels of, I guess, appreciation or awareness that I've seen over the years with families and with veterans, including, vicarious trauma, the family members growing up with a veteran or a service member who has active PTSD and issues, it does affect them. And they do kind of develop their own issues sometimes. So I don't know if that answers your question or not, but I mean, I, you know, over the years, you know, having labels is important, I guess, at one side of it, but I think, you know, you put labels to the side when you really get in there with the person and sit with them and try to help them. It's about what they present with and how you can help them with it.
Yeah, the other thing I've noticed as sort of an outsider observing this is for the counselors, it's just wildly overwhelming. There are not enough services to refer folks to. They're dealing with their own, you know, reasonable, you know, if not trauma, at least, you know, how do I, you know, burnout, I guess is the right word.
Yes.
It's an overwhelming job. Self-care. Yeah. And so there's so many issues going on. And, you know, it must be frustrating for counselors because the mental health system that I'm aware of has like no or not sufficient support systems in place for folks who really need it. We could talk about this for the next 3 days.
Yeah, we need to invest more in the people that help people, and whether it's mental health or being an aid for someone with a physical disability or anybody in the helping professions. We just need to invest more in the people that help the people.
Thanks, Melody. I appreciate the question.
Thank you.
Deanna, who's next?
I don't have any hands at this time.
You don't? Okay.
No. So usually when I say that, though, Deanna,
interrupt me, you know, if hands get raised, and I will just continue our conversation. So, Annie, you had talked about the sort of small dogs in the rich people's house and the sort of quirky characters and which sort of mirror the quirky characters of the adults, I think, or at least the mom. But there are other dogs in the book as well. Talk about those other dogs. I think they're really interesting and the roles they play in the book.
Oh, well, I think I made a decision when I started writing this book that every fiction book that I have is probably going to have dogs in it.
You know, of course,
at a level that's not just, you know, just a mere mention. I believe that, you know, I've in the human and canine bond, you really do serve a purpose in this life. And if I can weave them into a story, I'm going to weave them into a story. But like I said, Abby did lose a dog to tragedy early on, and then she was introduced to Angel, who is a big Doberman, Eddie's running buddy, as he says. And she actually helped Abby kind of reopen herself to being loved by an animal because she had been so traumatized, she just cut herself off. You know, that was part of it. And then later on, she visits her dad and Augie's Belgian Shepherd kind of makes his way into her life as well. You know, but so the dogs kind of serve as a bridge and a, you know, to the relationships with people. And they show this unconditional, you know, regard for people. They also serve as, you know, comedy, you know, with Prince pees on her shoe when she first meets them all, you know, it's stuff like that. And then, you know, it shows how Abby can open up herself to other types of affection and love.
Okay, we have some hands.
Some hope there.
Oh, we got hands. Yes. Yep. Thank you, Annie.
Cool.
All right, let's do it.
All right.
First one up is 845 is the beginning of it. 918 is the end. 845, Erica.
Hello, it's Cheryl.
Hi, Cheryl.
Hello. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. Hi, you guys. Hi, everybody. Great book. I did not finish it, but I've read a lot of it. And great job, Annie.
Thank you.
Great job. And I'm appreciative of everything in it. Here's a little tidbit. Just before I got on, just before I unmuted, I thought, oh, yeah, let's just add in there, whether you're sighted or you're blind, dropping ice cubes and then stepping in them and stepping on them and my feet are all wet and blah, blah, blah. Imagine. Anyway, don't ask me why I said all that. I just wanted to tell you, great job. I'm glad I'm on here. I can't stay long, but big hug. And I've been here since the beginning. I'm glad to hear you. And great job reading, my dear. Thanks.
That'll pass. Thanks, Cheryl.
Thanks, Cheryl.
Appreciate that.
Next hand is Marcia Wick.
Hey, Annie,
hey,
Peter,
Marcia.
Deanna. Hi. So I'm working on a novel, and I'm wondering about how you structured it. Were you really looking closely at the total word count and word count per chapter and point of view and voice and ending and all of that? I mean, or did you just free flow that?
No, no, a lot of work. So what I did was I had a chapter synopsis document that I ran through, you know, in an outline form, you know, what I want to happen in chapter one and how I want it to bridge to chapter two and chapter three and a little synopsis of each one, whether I, you know, what scenes I wanted, whether I wanted dialogue or I wanted, you know, less dialogue or, you know, that kind of stuff. And the chapter synopsis document expanded as I wrote the book, and it kept me honest to what the outline was supposed to be, in terms of, you know, just getting the bones down for each chapter, and how I wanted to section it up. So that helped with keeping the plot in line. It helped me getting through the doldrums in the middle. I also had some character write-ups and who the characters were. And I had to keep track of the timeline as well. That was the hardest part for me in the book in terms of the mechanics of the novel itself was the timeline. I can't tell you how many times Lenore would send me an email and saying, well, this doesn't work because this doesn't add up. So I have to go back and make somebody older or make somebody younger or move the time back. So that was the hardest part for me because I'm not the kind of person that's that detail oriented in that way. I mean, I'm detail oriented in, I guess, different ways. But yeah, I needed somebody to keep me on track with the timeline and stuff. So does that answer your question? I hope so.
Okay, Annie, before we take the next question, I'm curious. We talked about how characters sometimes change the storyline. So how closely did the book adhere to your timeline, or to your outline? Forgive me, your outline.
It within a few years, either
okay.
way.
Okay.
I had originally made Abby a lot younger, and then I realized some of the things she'd experienced probably. I don't know. I just made her older.
Yeah.
And then I had to make some space with some of the later points in the book as well, mm-hmm. especially between her and Augie, and suddenly becoming, you know, 14 years old and. Interested, you know, with boys
the guys,
and
the,
all
yeah,
that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And all the guy yeah. stuff. So, yeah. So yeah. we had to do a little stretching.
Yeah. Deanna.
Marilyn has her hand up. You may unmute Marilyn.
Hey, Marilyn.
Okay. Are you ready for me to talk?
We are ready.
Go for it.
I don't want to interrupt anything.
No, go ahead.
I have not read your book yet, and I wonder if you could talk about how long it is and where it's available, what formats.
Sure. Great questions. So the book is about 250 pages, and it's available on all book-selling platforms, including Amazon and Kindle, Smashwords, and it's currently it just got put into the Bookshare system. It's not a Bard. It's not on the Braille and audio reading download yet, but it's also slated to be an Audible book, and narrated by Lillian Eves and Graydon Schlichter. I think at the end of the summer. So,
great. Thank you.
Yep. And you can find all of my books on my website. It's www.annchappetta.com. And that's spelled www.annchiappetta.com. Two P's and two T's.
Yes, that's important because it's taken me like 5 years. I've known Annie for that length to get her name right. So two P's and two T's.
Yes, Sally has her hand raised.
All right, Sally.
Thanks.
Hi, Annie. I've been a fan of Annie's work for years. What really strikes me is how she can move from one form of work to another, poetry, nonfiction, fiction, short stories, novel. I'm wondering, do you write, when you started to write this book, did you write it without writing any other work, or did you put this book aside for a little bit and thought, well, I'll write a fiction piece, or I'll write short fiction or poetry? How did you write it, and how long did it take?
Oh, great question. This book was in between lots of other things. I wrote a lot of short fiction, some short stories. This book started out probably about 5 or 6 years ago. I was fiddling around with a fictionalized book about growing up in the 70s and the trauma and all that. And it just kind of, it built upon itself. I would write a short story or whatever, and then I'd decide I wanted to write more. And I'd pick it up, and then I'd put it down. I'd pick it up, and I'd put it down. So it was one of those things that just built upon itself over time, and decided that it wanted to be written. But I practiced a lot with some of the other short stories in my book, A String of Stories from the Heart to the Future. There are a couple of stories in there, especially one summer, 1977, is in kind of the same genre, guess, or style that this book is. I played around with a lot of characters. I wrote a short story, a short story that's also in the String of Stories about the Eddie character that I put in another story. So there was a lot of that going on, a lot of cross-pollination before I settled on the characters and everything. So I did practice a lot with some other short stories before I wrote this, but it kind of just decided it wanted to get written.
So before we move on, I read that bunch of short stories. And Annie, could you get that title a little more slowly so we can find it? What's the
sure.
title of that?
It's called A String of Stories from the Heart to the Future. And it's on Amazon and Kindle. It's also on Audible, Smashwords. It came out in 2020. And it's 14 short stories, all different genres, from science fiction to romance to general fiction. And actually, there's two stories in there that do have visually impaired characters, protagonists.
And I really liked A String of Stories. The short stories are really fabulous. And so I encourage you to read all of Annie's stuff, but especially the last two. Any more questions, Deanna?
I think Marlene has her hand.
Marlene has her hand up.
All right, let's hear from Marlene.
Hi, everyone. I just wanted to say, in addition to this book, I have read A String of Stories, and I really enjoyed it. And Annie also has a nonfiction book, Follow Your Dog. And she has another book. Annie, I can't think of the title. You got another one?
There's Words of Life.
Okay.
And
Yes, and I have those as well. And Upwelling is very, very uplifting, and I really enjoy your fiction. Thank you.
And they're all available through your website, right, Annie?
Yeah, all on
our Anchepetta. Let's get it right. Yeah, okay.
I have my blog, Thoughtwheel blog, and
we've got three.
That's going to be the last question, I think.
Yes, we've got three more minutes.
Okay, so yeah, all right. Thank you, Deanna, for keeping track of the time. Go ahead. Who is the questioner?
No, we don't have any more questions.
Oh, okay.
I just needed to give you a heads up, so Annie can repeat again where her books are available.
So let's do that, and then I'll turn it over to Alice.
Okay. So my website is www.anchepetta.com, And my books are available on all ebook platforms, including Amazon, Kindle, Smashwords, and all my titles except for the most recent book, Hope for the Tarnished, are all on Audible as well.
Thank you, Annie, for the opportunity to interview you, and I wish you success in your future work and hope that you make lots of sales, if you will. The books are terrific. I now turn the floor over to Alice Massa, the president of Behind Our Eyes, to say a few words.
Thank you, Peter. What a fine interview. And congratulations again, Annie. I am delighted to say that I was able to read your book via my Echo device, and 5 books on the bookshelf from you. It's quite an accomplishment. We're delighted that you have been our 6th Beau book launch author, and we look forward to many more. We have people who are on the agenda for the remainder of this year. So we hope that many of you will be back to join us for another Beau book launch. And if you would like more information about our organization of writers with disabilities, Behind Our Eyes, please go to our website. It's just simply behindoureyes.org. And there you can find out so much information about all the other branches of our organization, our bi-weekly meetings, twice a month, I should say, of conference calls, and also our readers' workshop that meets once a month. We have small group critique sessions and just so much that our organization offers to writers. If you know someone who is blind, visually impaired, or has another disability and is also very interested in writing, please let that person know about our website, and you can go to the link that says Join Us, and from there you can fill out a very simple membership form. It's very easy to fill out, but if you have trouble doing so, just membership at behindoureyes.org. You can send an email. There are no dues whatsoever to join our organization that was established back in 2006. So thanks to all of you. Deanna, thank you as well for your technical hosting and your other helpers there this evening as well. And again, congratulations, Annie, and thanks to everyone who's joined us this evening.
Thanks, Alice. I'd like to thank Peter for being here and being such a great interviewer, giving me the opportunity to get the things out that I needed to say about the book. Also thank Princess Tia for helping with some of the co-hosting in the background. She also backed up this recording with her own, so I wanted to thank her for that. And thanks, Deanna, and thanks, ACB, for helping out with making this a community call. And thanks, everybody, for coming and being interested in writing and creativity. And everyone, have a good night.
Evening, everyone. I'm about to hit the kill switch.